Welcome back, everybody, to Where It Really Matters. I'm Tablet Deputy Editor Jeremy Stern with you in Los Angeles. I'm here, as always, with Walter Russell Mead, Tablet News Writer, Global View Columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and Distinguished Fellow at Hudson. Let's start with this week's news. First story of the week. The IDF has decided how it will counterstrike Iran and its proxies, but has not yet settled on the timing, multiple sources told the Jerusalem Post this week. Because the timing is still variable and because of all the necessary complex preparations, the current decision could change. However, the very development of a decision shows the severity and determination of Israel's leadership to strike back, though all indications are that Jerusalem still seeks to tamp down the attack to avoid spiraling into a regional war. Some signals indicate that the Air Force would be involved in an unusually significant target. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant on Tuesday said, quote, "The Iranians failed in their attack, and they will fail to deter Israel. The skies of the Middle East are wide open for the Israeli Air Force. Every enemy that comes after us will be struck wherever they are," close quote. Walter, news or faux news?
I would say faux news. It's like, yeah, we've decided what we're going to do, but of course that could vary, and it's not going to be right away, but it's going to be real. Okay, that sounds like you're keeping every possible option open, but you're making it sound like you've got something really decisive in mind. Well, why would you do that if you're Israel? Well, there's several reasons you would do it. One is you want domestic opinion to feel that you're really, you know, you do have this in hand. I mean, everybody in Israel just sort of spent a night in shelters or feeling under threat. And while it didn't turn out to be too terrible, think how the entire United States went crazy when there was a Chinese balloon passing over. Imagine, and they had the shock of October 7 and now this. If like 6 months after 9/11, there'd been a massive missile strike on the U.S. from the Middle East, the politics would have been really there. So they certainly need to look like they're doing something. Then you've got the international situation where, you know, if I think probably something of what's going on is going to be that the Israelis are maybe telling a lot of folks in Europe and the United States, listen, you know, there's Rafah and there's Iran. We got it. We want to take both. We want to deal with both. Tell me something, you know, and so if I were Israel, I would be trying to sell the level of my response to Iran in order to get more room for doing something in Rafah. So we need to kind of see how all of that settles out. And the one thing you can be sure of is that the stuff you're reading in the newspapers on something like this, and things that sources are whispering here and there, we're in the bazaar. I can't sell you this rug. This, my grandmother made this for her wedding. It's really important in my family. All right. There's absolutely, I would never put this on the market. Did you have an offer in mind? None of this, unless you believe everything that the rug merchant tells you in the store, you should consider this faux news.
Speaking of that, do you have a sense of where the Biden administration actually is on it? I know Biden said that Israel should take the win and doesn't need to retaliate against Iran because the attack last weekend showed Israel is ultimately safe under allied protection. And on the other hand, Secretary Blinken was quoted this week saying that Israel was lucky it didn't suffer worse damage and that Iran may really hurt them next time if provoked again. So does the administration think Iran is too weak to retaliate against or too strong to retaliate against?
The administration does not want a war in the Middle East that would drive up oil and therefore gasoline prices before the U.S. election. So it does not want Israel to retaliate. It feels a lot like the parent in the front seat of the car and the kids are squabbling in the back seat of the car. And the parent really at this point just wants the kids to shut up.
All right, our second story. The International Monetary Fund leveled an unusually direct criticism at U.S. policymakers this week, saying the country's recent standout performance among advanced economies was in part driven by an unsustainable fiscal policy. The exceptional recent performance of the United States is certainly impressive and a major driver of global growth, the IMF said in its annual World Economic Outlook. but it reflects strong demand factors as well, including a fiscal stance that is out of line with long-term fiscal sustainability, close quote. Washington's overspending, the report said, risks reigniting inflation and undermining long-term fiscal and financial stability around the world by ratcheting up global funding costs. Walter, news or faux news?
Well, it's true, but it is so obvious that it's hard to call it news. I suppose, the fact that the IMF feels compelled to say it, maybe that's a little bit newsy. But if you don't understand that the American budget is on a completely unsustainable course and that it's going to start impacting us, then you just haven't been paying attention. And part of the problem, honestly, is that not only is our debt going up, but like a bunch of idiots, when interest rates were really, really low, we didn't put our treasury debt on the longest term basis possible. There were countries that that back when interest rates were near zero, I think maybe it was Austria, that was selling 100-year bonds. So they lock in those low interest rates, and investors were happy to have them at the time. All right. But no, the United States, we are much too smart for that. And so we have a bunch of treasury debt that has to be, continually refinanced at these rising interest rates, which make the deficit worse, which means that then there's more inflationary pressure, which drives up interest rates, which therefore means the next time we have to come back, not only to handle some new debt, but to roll over some old debt is going to be even more expensive. So we have worked ourselves into a beautiful little trap here. And, back early in the Clinton administration, one of his advisors, now I can't even remember who, it was a long time ago, said, when I die, I want to come back as the bond market, because the bond market always gets what it wants. And we, I think, are going to be coming to the point, certainly in a second Biden term, but I think also in a Trump term, where a president has these huge fantasies of enormous spending, trillions of dollars to my beloved constituents and so on. And you try to do that, and suddenly inflation goes up, interest rates go up, and those constituents want to hang you from a lamppost in front of the White House. This is something America has not experienced for 25, 30 years. It's unpleasant, and it makes politics edgier. We're moving in that direction. So this is real. It's happening. It's not really news, but maybe it's news that people are paying attention.
All right, final story of the week. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed frustration after the U.S. and its allies swooped in to defend Israel against a massive Iranian attack last weekend, highlighting the limits of Western support for Kyiv, according to the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. and a coalition of Western and Arab partners shot down nearly all the hundreds of drones, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles fired by Iran on Saturday before they even reached Israeli airspace. Ukrainians, in contrast, have been pleading for months for greater protection against Russian attacks that have intensified while vital aid from the U.S. remains stalled in Congress. Now the whole world has seen from the actions of Israel's allies in the sky and neighboring countries how effective unity can be in the protection from terror, Zelensky said. Terror must lose everywhere and completely, not somewhere more and somewhere less. Walter, news or faux news?
I would have to say here a little bit of faux news. Of course, he's going, no matter what he's thinking, if you're a Ukrainian and you've just been getting, your powers out because the Russians have hit, and now you see what's going on in Israel, you're going to be annoyed. And as a politician in Ukraine who's accountable to those people, you will want to vent that annoyance. And why not? But probably Zelensky understands, the reasoning behind it. I don't think it's particularly, noble or anything like that. But as far as I can make out, the Biden administration genuinely and sincerely believes that if Joe Biden loses in November to Donald Trump, it is the end of democracy in the United States and the end of freedom in the world. Nothing must be allowed to happen that makes that re-election less likely. And one of those things that would make that re-election less likely is a huge spike in oil prices that makes American drivers unhappy at the gas pump. And that also makes inflation go back up, all of these things. So he is definitely working to stop that. And so the message to Ukraine is, don't hit any Russian oil refineries. And the message by in the Middle East is, let's keep this conflict at the lowest level possible. So I think there is a coherent American policy on both on both theaters. It's not, oh, we love Israel, so we're going to protect Israel, and we really don't care that much about Ukraine, so we're not going to help Ukraine. That's not what's working. And it's also, by the way, not that those powerful string-pulling Jews are like, you know, pushing, you know, oh, well, you Israel must be protected, Ukraine can suffer. That's not what's going on at all either. It's President Biden really does believe, and his top aides, I think, agree, that if he loses this election, it's game over for the greatest experiment in freedom in the history of the world, and he's not going to let that happen.
All right, that does it for this week's news. Let's have the big conversation. The rise of work from home threatens a massive dislocation in the life of the American city, a shift that is likely to be much more far-reaching than the shift between the rail and car cities that the 20th century witnessed. This raises an important policy question. Should public policy attempt to promote work from home, slow it down, or take no stand at all? My own view is that work from home and the suite of technologies in its train that promise to upend the rules of urban geography offer historic opportunities that we should seize with both hands. To revitalize the American economy, bolster American democracy, and promote the well-being of American society, we need to move toward a new kind of tech-enabled city in which the rising generations can prosper and flourish in ways we can only imagine today, close quote. Walter, that's you writing today in the pages of Tablet in a new essay called The Rise of the Cyber City. Tell us what you mean.
Okay. I think working from home is not just like the fact that a bunch of Americans get to like stay home every, you know, and it's nice, and I like it. But it's also, it really is the start, not the full thing, but the start of a revolution. Why is this? Well, cities have been the kind of center of, well, civilization, a word that comes from the word city, civis. As if my Latin is still active somewhere in the back of my brain. Civitas and civis, I guess, is citizen. We see, you know, geography and technology, their interplay has been shaping cities for a very long time. In the old days, you know, pre-modern times, you know, citizens had to eat. And city obviously isn't growing food. So the amount of food you could get into the city really determines the size of the population that the city can support. And this meant that cities needed to be on or very, very close to ports, because you can only, you know, it's really actually transport over land. Even today, most long distance transport is by water rather than by land. And imagine what it's like when the only way to get food to the city is to have ox carts bring it in. Well, those oxes are eating every day. You know, it's more than 3 days. They would eat more hay and more food than you could fit on the back of a wagon that they could pull. So cities were close on rivers or on ports, and their size was determined by what you could get in there. And of course, it's not just food, but it's the stuff that they import, the stuff that they export, the raw material they turn into finished goods, blah, blah, blah. Well, the railroad comes along, and suddenly it's much easier to feed. You can get food in from miles away. Argentina can feed the Rhineland in Germany. It's a totally different situation. So 19th, 20th century railroad-based cities grow really fast. Like Chicago went from fields in the prairie to major world city, in a generation. I mean, it was astonishing, and it was happening all over the world. And these cities were large, but they were very centralized because, again, you know, it's very expensive to travel by rail. And most working people, you basically had to walk or take like a, you know, some kind of, the last mile is hard in a rail city. And development has to cluster. So land is very expensive. In New York, you had something like 250,000 people per square mile in parts of Manhattan, insane population densities. And of course, it stratifies wealth. Wealth is being created in these rail cities on a huge scale. You know, the Industrial Revolution creates massive amounts of wealth, but it tends to be a very stratified kind of thing. You've got working people who are working in factories, not making a lot of money, and renting, paying through the nose to live in horrible tenements that are close enough to the smoky, filthy factories where they work that they can actually get there without spending their meager wages on transportation. Right. So some people are getting stupendously rich, but you're getting a lot of people stupendously poor who don't own anything and never will own anything. For America, this kind of city, on the one hand, made us the greatest industrial power in the world, the irresistible force in World War I and World War II. So in that sense, a very good thing. But it was also a real threat to the idea of American democracy, because the thing that makes American democracy work, and this is what people have thought from the founders for generations, is that unlike most traditional societies around the world, in America, the majority of people were owners. In early America, they lived on family-owned farms, and they were independent farmers, the majority, obviously not everybody. And even in the very small cities, you would start as an apprentice, work your way up in the craft, and then when you reach master craft level or whatever, you start out on your own, you operate your own independent blacksmith, or you save your money and open a store, or you go out to the open frontier and start a farm. But that the average American was an entrepreneur, an owner operator, and this meant that that their life experience gave them the kind of canniness that you need to have a citizenship that knows what it's doing. Taxes are kind of high, but it would be really good to have, you know, French lessons in the public schools. And do I want my taxes to go up so that my kids can study French? Or do I want the taxes to stay low? And well, man, who needs French anyway? That's a difficult decision. You can make a good argument either way. But the point is, if you pay property taxes and you know that you pay property taxes, you think about it. And if you're operating a farm as a business or a blacksmith shop, you understand how costs work. You understand where profit comes from. And so you have, from your life experience, the mental sort of background that enables you to think rationally and sensibly about the policies that different candidates stand for. Not that you always do the smart thing, but there's a shot. There's a reasonable shot that enough people will. So the rail city means this isn't happening. You know, the young apprentice is not going to go out and operate like a textile factory or a steel factory on their own. They're going to be a worker for life, and they're a renter. And the family farmers are being driven off the land because the economy no longer really works for family farming. So the rail city was creating this kind of social crisis and even identity crisis in America. And what happens, what comes along, is the automobile and people like Robert Moses, who builds the freeways so that you can get in and out of the inner city. And A.P. Giannini, this, you know, the greatest American that nobody knows anything about, who sort of pioneered the 30-year self-amortizing mortgage, which means that the price of an average house is roughly equal to what you'd have to pay in rent to live there, making housing affordable. And so after, beginning really as early as the 20s, but really taking off after World War II, Americans en masse moved from living in tenements in the inner city to or apartments, crowded apartments, out into the burbs where they're homeowners, and they acquire equity and they pile up wealth, right? And even today, for middle income Americans, just about half of their net worth is in real estate equity. That is their owner occupied home. Well, the boomers actually, this system which created wealth, poured wealth on generations of America, kind of choked when I was a kid, the boomer era in the 70s, inflation spikes, interest rates spiked. There's about 8 or 9 years when it really looked like we would not be able to buy homes of our own. And oh my gosh, the boomers, it was amazing what we used to hear. We wouldn't be the first generation in America that didn't have the living standards of their parents. All those horrible things they say to terrify Zoomers today, they told us when we were the same age. Okay, what fundamentally changed there? It was that in the 80s, actually, you know, oil prices came down, interest rates came down, and we were able to do what our parents and even grandparents had done and buy our own homes, right? And do the burb thing, all right? Zoomers in the 21st century, a more complicated set of problems is making it harder for Zoomers to do, and some particularly younger millennials to do what others have done. And that is, but the main difference is the car city, which made all this possible, we're reaching the kind of natural limits. You know, that with the car city, you could live 30 miles, 40 miles away from your workplace and commute every day reasonably. But now all of the housing that's within that 30 or 40 miles radius, right? All the developable land has been developed. And some people say, sure, well, let's do more density, apartments and stuff like that. That's part of the answer. But that still doesn't give you the same chance to have a house with a yard and the kind of equity that the kind of opportunity and living conditions that you thought you were going to have. And it makes it harder for you to be an owner, which is, again, important for the health of American democracy and American society. Well, here comes working from home. Here comes the pandemic. Woo! All of a sudden, it becomes clear that almost half the country really does not need to go into the office every day to make things happen. What that means, if you're going to commute 5 times a week, a 90-minute commute is insane. It's unmanageable, which means as a younger family, you've got to either buy a house that's so far out that you wreck your life on the commuting, or you have to try to find some way to rent something, you know, or maybe buy something really small and really unsatisfactory that's close enough to get to work. Now, if you only have to go in once or twice a week, well, you know, 90-minute commute isn't fantastic, but it might be manageable. You could do it. And this opens up huge expanses of developable land for the next generation. And doing that, it won't just like put these folks in homes, right, and give them a chance to apply equity. There'll be a big construction boom building these houses. There's infrastructure to be built, the roads, the sewers, the electric lines, all the stuff will need to be built, which is good investable money for the financial system, stable, non-speculative investments that provide a healthy yield, which is kind of what a financial system needs to not be so like loosey-goosey, all over the place, Wall Street crazy speculation. All right. All of this stuff can happen. So I think government policy should be doing everything possible to promote this. For example, I think companies that figure out how to manage their employees in a way that more of their employees can stay home more of the time, they're saving the rest of us money. They're cutting the emissions on the commute. It cuts the cost of the infrastructure that a given city needs when you can make rush hour, you know, less of a horror for everyone. Puts less strain on the bridges and means you don't have to add that extra lane onto the New Jersey Turnpike again. All of these kinds of things, those are real savings. So tax policy could, in fact, provide incentives for companies to do that. People who live in homes should and use part of their home as an office, it should be a lot easier for folks to take a tax deduction on that and write off some of that cost. There's a whole suite of technologies that come along with this that could make it enable more people to work at home and to come into the office less while still getting the job done, still doing everything that a company needs to do. I think smart cars that one day maybe will have door-to-door, self-driving cars, so you can like do your email and work while you're commuting, so that 90-minute commute isn't lost time. It's time you can actually get stuff done in. That would be fantastic. But even before you get to that door-to-door, maybe there's a way to make our freeways enabled so that smart cars could work on the freeways. And it's kind of the last mile is when you have to drive. That you can have transitional plans to get you the full benefits of this thing. All right. These are things, by the way, these would make the world greener without making people give up things that they want. Save the planet by not commuting every day. All right. That's actually a popular green idea rather than wear a hair shirt, be miserable, and drive a car that you don't like. Right. It would also mean if people have to work less, travel less for work, a lot of families that now need two or three cars could probably get by with one. There are a lot of ways that this transition can make our economy more human, enrich Gen Z, and make our economy greener, more sustainable. So I think this is, this is the most, even before the pandemic, I was like saying, let's do this. But I think the pandemic, which did a lot of damage to a lot of folks, had this merit that it showed us that something that many people didn't think was even imaginable is actually totally practical. Let's do it.
You mentioned in passing in the essay that you think Republicans might be better positioned than Democrats to lead this transition, and that if they can, they might be able to look forward to a generation of political dominance. Why do you think the GOP is in the potentially stronger position here, and do you think they have what it takes?
The second part is really the hard part, isn't it? But okay, why is this something that's going to be easier for Republicans to go to? And the answer is this, that the Democratic Party, sort of a lot of its base is in these inner cities, the rail cities, the old hubs of downtown New York, these old places. And they're great cities. I love them. I live in downtown Washington. I love New York, et cetera, et cetera. But they've got very high cost structures, and they really want, the mayor of Washington is begging the federal government, make those federal workers come in. I don't care. I don't care if they can do their jobs just as well. Make them all get in their cars, drive downtown, and spend money in Washington, D.C. so that my municipal budget works. All right. There's a lot of that going around. There are a lot of banks that are looking at commercial real estate values that are going down. I want, make those people come back in here and sit here and do their jobs where I can watch them and tax them, and where they have to like buy their lunch, where I can tax their lunch, and it provides jobs for people who, it's not all bad stuff. And then many of these cities have hugely inflated cost structures, based on everything from sweetheart deals with public sector unions, ratcheting up wages and pensions to unmanageable levels in a sort of corrupt partnership with elected officials, to real estate interests and sort of other monopoly groups that have really, shaped the evolution of cities in ways that suit them very, very well. All right. These cost structures were already becoming unsustainable before the pandemic. But you look at, you have an extremely expensive transit system. If people on that, if riders on that system even drop 20%, you have a big budget deficit. If your commercial real estate drops 40 and 50%, which it may well be doing in many, many cities, you have a huge tax problem. if people who used to work downtown 5 days a week now come downtown, you know, twice a month, all right, you can't really tax their incomes. There are a lot of problems. And the Democratic Party is structurally tied to these interests. So there's going to be, I mean, already a lot of national politics is Democratic cities fighting for money that they want to come in from the suburbs, the exurbs, and so on. And the suburbs and the exurbs are less sympathetic to this. Well, I think this is going to exacerbate that tension. So it is an opportunity, I think, you know, maybe it's a new party. Maybe both of our parties are kind of clapped out and we need something new. But I think Republicans would have an easier time sort of saying, okay, we want a young family agenda. We want an exurban agenda. We want to kind of leave these failed city cores behind. That kind of, you know, tallies with a lot of individualistic Republican thinking. But I think this is popular. I think, you know, in a healthy political system, we'll end up with a competition between parties both trying to push this idea, because this is, I think, the best way forward for Gen Z, at least it's the best one that I can see.
All right, that does it for the big conversation. Let's end on the tip of the week. You were called on to testify to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week, Walter, where you talked about modernizing U.S. alliances in the Indo-Pacific. I'm not sure how many of our listeners have congressional testimony in their futures, but for those who do, tell us kind of what these are, what the point is, and what makes for crafting a good one.
Well, you know, I mean, it's very different. There are a lot of different committees and the House committees are different from the Senate committees. And what you really don't want to do, by the way, is be the president of an Ivy League university called before a House committee. Let's just say that right away. And, you know, foreign affairs committees work. Generally, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has a history of being reasonably bipartisan, though, of course, people are always looking for that little extra advantage. Generally speaking, senators have more options of getting news coverage, so they can afford to be a bit more laid back in a hearing, while people in the House are sort of thinking, this is the only time all month there's going to be a camera anywhere in my direction. And so I need to, you know, be there and, you know, be very visible. So you need to know who you're going to be seeing and what they're interested in. That's part of it. The other thing is that you've got in virtually any hearing, there's going to be two testimonies that you prepare. One is your written testimony, which will be a number of pages and where you can sort of lay out arguments at great length. And generally what happens is that this goes to the offices of the people in the hearing a few days before. Their staffers will generally read it. You know, they're not, I think, that many people have the time. The senators have the time to read all the written testimony that's coming in from all the hearings and so on. So staffers will go through that, maybe give a briefing to the senator, or maybe just give a few questions to be asked based on it. And then you have usually a few minutes at the start of a hearing for your oral testimony. And, you know, to some degree, that needs to obviously be a precis or of your, you know, needs to have some relationship to your written testimony. But I say in general, it's important for that oral testimony to be interesting. And so you should kind of approach them in a slightly different way, which, again, I guess we're probably going to put the link up somewhere on this to the testimony, so people can see the written testimony, and then ultimately the oral spoken thing, and then ultimately the written testimony goes up on the record, so that's searchable too, and you can take a look and see how I and others do this. But that's, you know, now again, this is different from, say, a confirmation hearing where they're grilling you about you, right? That can be much more adversarial. Something like this, where the Foreign Affairs Committee is trying to understand issues that are of interest to them as they think long term. That's a very different kind. So there, again, in this particular hearing, everybody's trying to understand something. So that is a much less, those are the kinds of hearings you want to be in, I would say. You actually, there's a chance for intelligence. The other thing, I suppose, is in this hearing, I actually had some pretty smart people asking questions, and that really helps. This is a pretty high quality group of people. You know, they have a grasp. They know the issues are important. So it was, and very often, really, it would be not that easy to tell the difference whether a senator, if you didn't know who was asking the question, it wouldn't be that clear whether it was a Republican or a Democrat.
All right, there you have it. Thanks to our producer, Noam Bloom. Thanks to Will Cummings at Hudson and my co-host, Walter Russell Mead. I'm Jeremy Stern. We'll see you next week. And until then, please go rate and review us. This helps other people find the show.